From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The Board of Pardons and Paroles voted to allow Mr. Graham's execution to go forward. I support the board's decision.
Clearly he had been struggling. He was lying on the gurney, handcuffed and shackled. And then they put before him a mic, allowed him to say his last words, at which time he declared first his innocence. I did not kill Lambert.
Right.
The state is killing an innocent man. Right.
Shackled and beaten up, Shaka Sankofa, Gary Graham, was executed last night at 9:49. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. It was 9:49 Eastern Time, 8:49 Texas Time. A defiant Gary Graham was executed in the state of Texas. Gary Graham, also known as Shaka Sankofa, struggled as he went to his death, insisting he was innocent moments before the execution that presented Governor George W. Bush with the loudest outcry over capital punishment since he began his run for president. Shaka Sankofa received a lethal injection. The Texas State Parole Board and appeals courts rejected Graham's arguments that he was convicted on shaky evidence from a single eyewitness with no other supporting evidence and that his trial lawyer did a poor job. Bush said he supported the execution, the 135th during his 5.5 years in office. He said the case had been reviewed by 33 judges in 19 years. It was the 222nd killing by the state of Texas since the death penalty was reinstated. A Justice Department prosecutor is recommending that a special counsel investigate whether Vice President Al Gore lied about his role in 1996 Democratic campaign fundraising. The recommendation from Robert Conrad, supervising attorney for the Justice Department's Campaign Finance Task Force, was made weeks ago after he questioned Gore about a Buddhist temple fundraising event Gore attended and other topics. Word of Conrad's recommendation leaked out yesterday, and an angry Attorney General Janet Reno launched an internal investigation into how that happened. This, according to a Democratic senator familiar with the work of the task force. Two government officials said a central issue for the task force is whether Gore gave accurate answers about his fundraising activities. Northern Ireland's largest pro-British paramilitary group is apparently sticking by its nonviolence pledge for now. The British news agency Press Association says the Ulster Freedom Fighters have suspended a threat to call off their 1994 ceasefire. The ceasefire was vital to talks leading to the Good Friday Peace Accord 2 years ago. The group had warned it would call off the ceasefire and shoot anyone attacking Protestant homes in North and West Belfast as of midnight Tuesday, but it now says talks between community leaders should begin. A brief court appearance today for the Dutch man who was driving a truck in which dozens of Chinese illegal immigrants died. Perry Wacker was remanded into police custody at the hearing in London. Wacker yesterday became the first person to be charged in the immigrant smuggling case. He faces 58 counts of manslaughter. Police, meanwhile, are interrogating four other people. Authorities are still trying to identify the bodies found in an airtight compartment when the truck arrived in the port of Dover last Sunday. U.S. troops will remain in South Korea indefinitely despite the diplomatic thaw on the Korean Peninsula, this according to Secretary of State Madeleine Albright today. The summit meeting last week between the leaders of the two Koreas was, quote, a bold first step toward a brighter picture for the region, said Albright. But the 37,000 troops are essentially to deter aggression and to promote stability through the area, said the U.S. Secretary of State after talks with South Korean President Kim Dae-jung and Foreign Minister Lee Jong-bin. The New York State Assembly is expected to follow the lead of the state Senate and pass a new gun control bill today. The Senate last night approved a bill that requires mandatory trigger locks and raising the legal age to buy a handgun from 18 to 21. The bill also calls for New York to become one of the first states to require ballistic fingerprinting of firearms. Shell casings from the test firing of a person's gun would be sent to a state police forensic lab. Computerized images of the casings would serve as, quote, fingerprints for the gun and would be kept on file. In April, Maryland passed the nation's first law requiring built-in locks and ballistic fingerprinting for all new handguns. In this news from San Francisco, Wells Fargo & Company has overhauled an online home referral program that described poor neighborhoods as places heavily populated by blacks who tend to buy, quote, takeout food from chicken restaurants. The San Francisco-based bank, one of the nation's largest mortgage lenders, took the action yesterday, a day after a nonprofit activist group filed a federal lawsuit alleging the racial descriptions violated the Fair Housing Act. Sam, the return, till we do something about it, here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman in New York, and Juan Gonzalez is joining us in Houston, Texas, co-hosting the program just about an hour and a half away from Huntsville, Texas, where yesterday Gary Graham was executed. Beaten up and handcuffed Shaka Sankofa, Gary Graham was executed by the state last night at 8:49 Texas time. He reportedly kept his vow to fight like hell when the authorities tried to strap him to the gurney. He'd refused to eat his final meal on the table of those who would execute him, and when it came time for him to be transferred to the room where he would die, he resisted. The prison sent in what they called a cell extraction team to remove him by force. It took five jail guards to strap him to the gurney. Handcuffed, Graham gave a six-minute statement in which he asserted his innocence and called his execution a lynching. He reportedly died looking at the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who was a witness in the chamber. His final words, "They're murdering me tonight." After Shaka Sankofa, Gary Graham was executed, the reporters who'd witnessed the killing came outside the prison and gave their account of what happened.
I'll be able to tell you what happened tonight. Our first reporter will be Mike Grotchik of the Associated Press.
I'm going to have Lloyd Guyte from Fox 26 come here also. We had a long, rambling, and very angry statement from Mr. Graham, who said at the conclusion, or near the conclusion, that he wanted to be known as Shaka Sankofa.
Louder.
Can you hear us? Can you hear us now?
No.
They can't hear us. Get closer to the microphone. Can you hear us now? Good.
Let me repeat that. We had a long, rambling, and angry final statement from Mr. Graham, who included among his comments that he wanted to be known as Shaka Sankofa. It was very obvious from the way he looked that he had put up a struggle. He was restrained with black Velcro restraints at his wrists. He had a very rumpled white prison shirt on. He was covered for the most part with a sheet, which is fairly unusual for executions that we see here in Texas. He had a restraint across the top of his head that was designed to keep his head from moving. During the course of his statement, it slipped off. I believe, although I did not see, some of my colleagues did, that he was handcuffed to the death chamber gurney.
I did see the handcuffs. I understand that it is not normal for a prisoner to have handcuffs on him. He was handcuffed. We were not able to see his hands. I did see some bruises on his upper arm. He also said when he first started talking to us that he was innocent of the killing of Bobby Lambert. He said he did not, in fact, kill Bobby Lambert. And he said that he, Gary Graham, is being murdered today. He said this was, in fact, a lynching. And he said to Bobby Lambert's family, "I did not kill Bobby Lambert." He says that the officials here know the truth and that the truth at some point will come out, but that he did not kill him.
In the course of his statement, he also invoked the names of Nelson and Winnie Mandela. He repeatedly talked about marching on, black power. If you bear with me, I'll try to go through some of my notes here about the statement. Again, it was quite long. Those of you who have seen Mr. Graham know he talks very quickly.
He also talked about Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. He said that they stood up and died for what was just, insinuating that he too did stand up and die for what is just. He also said that there will be 100 more years of this kind of lynching if we do not do something and do something fast. He said this murder has to be avenged. He said we will go forward by any means necessary. And if you have talked to Gary like I had just a few days ago, he said that any means necessary also means weapons. So he reiterated by any means necessary before he died.
He said, "I die fighting for what I believed in. The truth will come out." He thanked his supporters. He expressed love to the Reverend Jackson, L. Sharpton, Bianca Jagger, and the minister Robert Muhammad, who were in the death chamber with us. He urged that they take his case to an international court. He said that they had been beaten here, that he would like them to expose the brutality that he endured. And he said, "You must continue to demand a moratorium on executions." He said he expressed love to his son and his daughters, and he said he urged them to hold their heads up.
He also said, "You can kill a revolutionary, but you cannot stop the revolution." He also said, as Mike has said, take this to international courts. He also said that there are tapes that are available of him being abused by the prison officials, him being pepper sprayed by the prison officials. He said that the people must get a hold of those tapes and make those tapes public to prove that this nation does not act in a civilized manner.
He said that, quote, I was chosen for this genocide. This is part of genocide where black people, this is part of the genocide that we as black people have endured in America.
He also said this is a Holocaust for black people in America. And Bianca Jagger started crying as he was talking, and the Reverend Jesse Jackson's eyes were very red. We were in the particular section with those people. It was a very emotional time. Reverend Jesse Jackson said a prayer, and Reverend Al Sharpton also said a prayer, as well as Robert Muhammad, the spiritual advisor to Gary Graham. He said a prayer as well.
He said, this is nothing more simple than murder, state-sanctioned murder in America. They know I'm innocent. They won't acknowledge it.
He said, this is genocide in America. He also said, this is what happens to black men. Now, as the drugs were going into his body, he looked over at us and he just sort of went silent. He died with one of his eyes open and one of them closed. And he was looking at the Reverend Jesse Jackson when, in fact, he did die.
Just before they administered the drugs, he said, keep marching, black people, black power. And he said that twice. Quite a lot of anger in his voice. So they are killing me tonight. They are murdering me tonight.
And then the doctor came in and examined him and pronounced him dead. They then placed a white cotton towel over his face, and we exited.
As Lloyd said, there was little reaction to the drugs. I wrote down he had a slight groan, almost like an exhale, and his... one of his eyes was half open, the other eye was almost shut.
Questions, or do we just...
Hi, I'm Salathea Bryant, reporter with the Houston Chronicle. We were in with the victim's family at the front. There was Rick Sanford in the middle. Rick Sanford was a robbery victim of Mr. Graham's in 1981. In the middle was Bobby Hanners, who is the grandson of Bobby Lambert. And on the end was Justice for All President Diane Clements. Rick Sanford never took his eyes off Mr. Graham when he went into the room. And when we walked into the witness chamber, Mr. Graham turned his eyes to our side, and that's when he said, I'd like to say to the victim's family, I did not kill Bobby Lambert. We timed the statement. The statement was about 6 minutes long as we timed it. And a quote, march on, black people. All y'all leaders, march on. Push the moratorium for all black people. Push for it, all y'all doing it right. They know I'm innocent. They got the facts to prove it. We will prevail. Keep marching, black power. Keep marching, black power. And the last statement that I recorded before his death, they are killing me tonight. They are murdering me tonight. And he went silent. And, of course, the doctor identified the time of death at 8:49. And from what it appeared, Justice for All President Diane Clements at one point during the execution, she kept her head down at one point, had tissue in her hand, and wiped slight tears from her eyes. She wasn't crying heavily. She just patted her eyes a little bit. But as I said, Rick Sanford kept his eyes directly on Mr. Graham the whole entire time. And so did Mr. Hanners. He, as I said, he stood in the front, and he also kept looking at Mr. Graham's direction. And as Mike and Lloyd have said before, when we arrived in the room, that he had sort of like an ace bandage, I guess, that was wrapped around his forehead and around the bed. But that slipped off in the process of his statements because he was rather lengthy, and he was also very breathy in his talking, very excited, I guess, and very breathy in his statements. He really at all times had a huge vein down the center of his forehead there, so he's really expressing himself in a very strong manner.
849.
I'm sorry, and also in with the victims was Roe Wade. She is an appellate specialist in the Harris County. Roe Wilson. It's R-O-E Wilson. Roe Wilson. She is an appellate specialist in the Harris County District Attorney's Office.
In conclusion, I'd like to say that I do have a statement here from Bobby Hanners, who is Bobby Lambert's grandson. This was released just a short while ago. It says, "My heart goes out to the Graham family as they begin the grieving process. I also pray that Gary Graham had made his peace with God, but I truly feel that justice has been served." Thank you.
And some of the statements yesterday, the description of Gary Graham Shaka Sankofa's execution just after 8:49, the time that he died in Texas. When we come back, we'll be hearing some of the lead-up, the decision of the Texas State Board of Pardons and Paroles, and also the Reverend Jesse Jackson, Reverend David Muhammad, the spiritual advisor of Shaka Sankofa, when they walked out of the prison, clearly stunned. And we'll be talking with Juan Gonzalez, who's in Houston right now. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman in New York. Juan Gonzalez is in Houston. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Juan.
Oh, good day, Amy, and to our listeners around the country. An amazing account by the some of the reporters that were there, and obviously very different views of those final moments of Shaka Sankofa waiting to be executed there, and shows you the disparity that often occurs between reporters who see the exact same event, and one calling his statement rambling, another calling it strong, one calling it long, another one timing it at 6 minutes, big difference in the way journalists see the same event sometimes.
It really was remarkable, like our producer David Love said, as if it was scripted. You had the white reporter, the AP reporter, Michael Grachik, and the black reporter from Fox 26 News, Lloyd Gait. And it was remarkable to hear them go back and forth as the AP reporter described the rambling statement, and Lloyd Gait, the Fox reporter, described the anger and the words like black power and revolution.
Yes, and the of course the execution here has really was the main news in Texas, with all of the local stations here broadcasting it live, and with many people at the conference that I was attending having being pulled away by their editors to go and cover the story, and it was the topic of conversation and has been now for several days here in Houston.
Talk about the conference that you've been at.
Well, this is the annual National Conference of Hispanic Journalists, and this year is being held in Houston. Interestingly, Governor George Bush was the opening night speaker at the conference, and there was a battle initially as to whether he would even answer questions, but he finally reluctantly agreed to do so. And the first question that was asked of the Hispanic journalists at the conference of Governor Bush on Wednesday night was what he was going to do about the case of Gary Graham, of Shaka Sankofa, and of course he repeated the same line he had said for throughout, that justice had been done, that he would that once the parole and pardons board made its decision, that he would then say exactly what he would do. And of course he clearly never intended to grant a reprieve, as was obvious by his statements afterwards, that a reprieve had already been granted by a previous governor, and that he could not do that.
You know, it was almost also as if the reporters who were covering the story, and it is quite remarkable the extent of coverage this has gotten. I mean, in a fair world, this would have gotten even more attention. But given the way the death penalty and executions have become business as usual in the United States, this particular execution, the 135th execution under George Bush's reign, the last 5.5 years, more executions under Bush than any governor in U.S. history, the 222nd execution in Texas since the death penalty was reinstated, it really shows the power of the abolitionist movement, that there is a real sea change in this country, and that this could become a true defining moment for George Bush. But the question is there an alternative? You couldn't have had less opposition from the Democrats yesterday in the person of Al Gore, vice president, so is both vice president and running for president, so in either capacity. When our producer Jeremy Scahill called Gore's office for comment on the Gary Graham case 2 days ago, they said he was the first reporter to have called. I find that hard to believe, but he was asked about it as he stood with Jesse Ventura and was asked questions also about an independent prosecutor being appointed in his own campaign financing case. He was asked about the Gary Graham case, and his first words were, "I support the death penalty," and so he has not made this an issue.
Of course, and you also have the amazing situation here of Reverend Jesse Jackson witnessing this execution when years ago he was campaigning for Bill Clinton when Clinton, in the middle of a presidential campaign, went back to his home state to execute a man to prove how tough he was as a presidential candidate. And now you have Jesse Jackson having to sit in on the first execution he has ever witnessed, and to come to grips with some of how our political leaders, even those that we support, continue to maintain the necessity of this barbaric situation that we continue to see only in the United States among all of the advanced countries of the world.
At the conference that you were at, a major Latino conference where we saw, you know, George Bush making that statement that he does not execute innocent people, was the death penalty overall a topic of discussion?
Yes, it generally was not. There were no panels on it per se, but it was definitely the main topic of conversation among the journalists, being so close to Huntsville and understanding how the Shaka Sankofa case has really elevated the debate over capital punishment, and especially the fairness of the system, even among those who support it. I think that it was definitely the main topic of conversation among the approximately 1,400 journalists attending the conference.
Well, we're going to go now for a minute, sort of a retrospective of what happened in the last day. It was a real roller coaster yesterday. It's quite something coming after 2 days before in Florida, in the state of George Bush's brother, Jeb Bush, where a prisoner who was on death row, Thomas Provenzano, was brought to the death chamber, had the needles put in his arm, and 10 minutes before he was slated to die, he got a reprieve. But that only happened for 24 hours about, and the next day he was killed. So you went from that to George Bush's territory, Texas, and yesterday, June 22nd, that a lot of people around the country had been preparing for. There were protests all over. In fact, I understand today in Los Angeles there'll be another protest at Republican headquarters of George Bush's decision to allow the execution to go forward. But I was saying earlier that I felt that a lot of the press coverage of the execution seemed also scripted. Nothing better to show for this than Pete Williams, who was the Pentagon spokesperson, helped craft the censorship rules for press during the Persian Gulf War and then became a lead reporter for NBC. And he did a sort of sidebar piece yesterday about why George Bush had no choice. Now, the lawyers seriously dispute whether George Bush had a choice. First of all, and I heard this repeated on every network, it wasn't up to him. It was up to the independent Texas State Board of Pardons and Paroles, a board that, as if listeners were listening to Democracy Now! Yesterday, they heard the discussion with Alan Berlow, who wrote the piece in American Prospect, Lethal Injustice, about this 18-member board, every one of them appointed by Bush. They haven't met for years. They get $80,000 a year in salaries, and they made this decision, as they made others, by fax. This is a board that, as yesterday, in the mainstream media, a former attorney general of Texas, Maddox, was interviewed, and he said, sort of scoffing at the idea that it was an independent board, that you just have the governor's aide give a call to the board, and he says what he wants. This board is under serious questioning. In fact, the final delay in the execution of Shaka Sankofa came when his lawyers filed after the Supreme Court refused to stay the execution. His lawyers filed a civil suit in federal court in Austin challenging the constitutionality of this Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles. But at the end of the day, you had each of the networks talking about how George Bush's hands were tied. He had to go along with the board. And speaking with Dick Burr, one of Gary Graham's attorneys, he said that even what it says in the rules, I think it's the Texas Constitution, about what a governor can do, that the reprieve earlier, they always use this example that a governor can only grant one reprieve, and Gary Graham was given it years ago under Democrat Ann Richards, and that was stressed by Bush, Democrat Ann Richards, the former governor, as well as reporters who did this story. They're saying that there's a real question about whether it means under a particular governor that George Bush could have done it as a new governor. He had never actually issued a reprieve in the Gary Graham case. But there are serious questions, obviously, and whether or not he could have changed this. And many people do feel he could have been the one to stop the execution of Gary Graham. He certainly could have spoken out with moral authority on this issue. But he didn't do it, and neither did the man that he is running against in November, and that is Al Gore, though there are others who are running, and we're going to hear about them later in the program, because the Green Party convention is taking place this weekend in Denver. Democracy Now! Will be there covering the campaign and the party and the nominations. It's expected that, of course, Ralph Nader will be the presidential candidate and Winona LaDuke will be the vice presidential candidate of the Green Party. But for right now, a retrospective on what happened yesterday. It was around 2:30 Texas time when the decision was handed down after the state board of pardons and paroles, I guess faxing each other, made their decision, and it was announced.
Following a full and careful review of the petition, A majority of the board has decided not to recommend a 120-day reprieve, commutation of the death sentence to a lesser penalty, or a conditional pardon. The vote is as follows. 120-day reprieve. The board voted 14-3 not to recommend a reprieve. Commutation to a lesser penalty. The board voted 12-5 not to recommend commutation. Conditional pardon. The board voted 17-0 not to recommend a conditional pardon. The chairman of the board, Gerald Garrett, of the Board of Pardons and Parole stated, "The members of the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles are fully aware of the responsibility we have in rendering our votes as part of the executive clemency review process. I can say unequivocally that the board's decision not to recommend clemency was reached after a complete and unbiased review of the petition and evidence submitted."
The Board of Pardons and Paroles voted to allow Mr. Graham's execution to go forward. I support the board's decision. Mr. Graham has had full and fair access to state and federal courts, including the United States Supreme Court. After considering all the facts, I am confident justice is being done. May God bless the victims, the families of the victims, and may God bless Mr. Graham.
I will tell you that who our witnesses will be for the execution tonight. For the reporters, for the pool reporters, it will be Mike Grochick, representing Associated Press, Michelle Lyons, the Huntsville Item, Wayne Sarge, representing United Press International, Salathia Bryant of the Houston Chronicle, and Lloyd Geit, Fox 26 out of Houston. The personal witnesses, as probably most of you know at this time, but we'll go ahead and read it now. It's the official list. This is the Reverend Jesse Jackson, Sr., listed as a friend. Bianca Jagger, listed as a friend. Okay. The Reverend Al Sharpton, Sheila Jackson Lee, and the Minister Robert Muhammad, the spiritual advisor. And we do have handouts which Mr. Castleberry and Ms. Espinosa are making available this time. There has been an addition to the victims' witnesses. We now have three victims' witnesses. We have Bobby Hamners, who is the victim's grandson, Diane Clemens, who is a family friend, and Rick Stanford, who is also listed as a family friend.
And that was Larry Fitzgerald, spokesperson for the Texas prison, where Gary Graham Shaka Sankofa was executed last night at 8:49 Texas time. And after he was killed, the witnesses came out. And among those who spoke was Minister Robert Muhammad, his spiritual advisor.
He rose above his status as being a racially oppressed person in this country into a great thinker, a revolutionary. The state feels that it put Gary Graham to death, but I contend that Gary Graham had died a long time ago. What they killed tonight was our hope that there is justice in this land. And I say, lastly, that this is the evil, the darkness, that apathy and complacency produced. If justice-loving people of all colors, races, nationalities, and religions don't look at this case in particular, and don't look at the death penalty overall, and say enough is enough, let's stop the killing, let's stop the violence, then I'm afraid for America. I'm afraid what God will do. The Supreme Court of the United States turned Shaka Sankofa down, but the Supreme Court of God and his angels will not be denied. America is the only power left on earth. This is a unipolar world we live in. She is the superpower alone. And I'm saying tonight that we must find another way. Life without parole. Stop killing mentally retarded people. Give innocent, poor people a fighting chance in the courts. And let us have a system that's fair for all, lest our whole system go down the drain the way that Sodom and Gomorrah, Egypt, Babylon, Rome, and all the ancient kingdoms whose dust and architecture we studied through our archaeologists now bear witness. This moral decay is killing this nation, and we can't get rid of our problems by killing our mistakes. In Texas, we are 50th in education funding, 49th in supplying money for our teachers.
And first in executions, the Reverend Robert Muhammad said as he came out of the prison watching Shaka Sankofa, for whom he was his spiritual advisor, be executed. He was followed by the Reverend Jesse Jackson.
We raised up the innocence of Gary Graham tonight because he was having to prove guilty to proven innocent. Here's a case where he was not afforded due process, did not have competent lawyers, did not have cross-examination. Pontius Pilate looked at the thief and the robber and said, I know they're guilty, but I have one. But he could not put his doubts into action because of his politics. So he turned to the polls and asked the crowd, what do you think? Mr. Bush turned to the crowd. His sense of better judgment, if his judgment is so faulty as to assume that reasonable doubt does not warrant a stay of execution, then it is in fact too faulty to lead.
You've been by the bedside of people who have been dying. You were there when Dr. King was shot, but what did it feel inside of you to sit there and watch somebody go from fully breathing to death?
Well, in the case of Dr. King, it was so instant. There was no anticipation. There was no build-up that death was imminent. There was just, we were in a conversation, and then he was shot, and in a matter of seconds, he was gone. In the case tonight, there was hope against hope. At 6 o'clock, the murder did not take place. And then 6:30. And then 7. And then 8. And then there was the, every time an elevator bell sounded or a door opened, there was the hope. It was not to announce that we had to go downstairs to watch this state-sponsored murder. And so the anticipation was so painful. And then clearly he had been struggling. He was lying on the gurney, handcuffed and shackled. And then they put before him a mic, allowed him to say his last words, at which time he declared first his innocence. I did not kill Lambert.
Right.
The state is killing an innocent man. He said over and over again, I urge you to fight for a moratorium. We must stop the killing. I love you, he said over and over again. And then as he talked, he did not realize that as he talked, the poison was coming into his body. At some point, he simply, painlessly talked no more. His life has been taken by the state. And thank you very much.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson, after witnessing the execution of Shaka Sankofa Gary Graham. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman in New York, broadcasting along with, but not alongside, Juan Gonzalez, who is at Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston. Juan, I'm looking at your piece in the New York Daily News today called Nader, Buchanan, and the Election.
Yes, Amy. There was actually an amazing shock, I think, occurred yesterday in Washington, both to the Democratic Party and the American Labor Movement, when Ralph Nader held a press conference with Jimmy Hoffa, the president of the Teamsters Union. And Jimmy Hoffa came out very strongly demanding that Nader and Pat Buchanan be included in presidential debates of this new presidential debate commission, this private organization that's been set up by the Democratic and the Republican parties and will be handling the presidential debates. And Nader, as many people around the country and Hoffa joining him now, are concerned about the way that the commission has, in essence, almost ruled out the possibility of third-party candidates being included in the debates by setting the bar for inclusion unnecessarily high, insisting that a candidate must be getting about at least 15% support in a variety of national public opinion polls before they will be considered to be a part of the debates with George Bush and Al Gore. Clearly an attempt to prevent third-party movements or third-party candidates from being heard by the rest of the American people.
That's right, Juan. And one aspect of the story is who's getting included in these debates. And the other is, as you were saying, who's bankrolling them. And Ralph Nader and a group of voters have sued the Federal Election Commission, charging that illegal corporate money is being used to finance the upcoming presidential debates. The lawsuit filed in federal district court in Boston seeks to strike down FEC regulations, which allow a small handful of U.S. corporations to contribute millions of dollars to help stage the debates. If successful, the case would have a dramatic impact on the structure of the presidential debates this fall. The Commission on Presidential Debates, which is a nonprofit corporation that organizes the debates, announced in January that Anheuser-Busch will serve as one of the national financial sponsors this year, as well as the sole national sponsor of its October 17, 2000 debate in St. Louis, Missouri. The company will pay more than $500,000 to underwrite that debate. The other corporate sponsors in the prior presidential election years have included IBM, J.P. Morgan, Philip Morris. The lawsuit says that the commission is continuing to raise and solicit additional corporate contributions for its debates, the first scheduled for Boston October 3rd. And we're joined on the telephone by Greg Luke from Boston. He's with the National Voting Rights Institute and one of the attorneys who filed the suit. Can you explain the grounds?
Sure, I'd be happy to. This lawsuit is based on a federal law that goes back 93 years. It's been reenacted a number of times. It's kind of a bedrock principle of campaign finance regulation in this country, and that is the fact that corporations are not allowed to make direct contributions or expenditures in connection with federal campaigns. And this policy has the obvious reasons of trying to prevent the corrupting influence of large amounts of money that are amassed in corporate treasuries from affecting the marketplace of ideas. And an interesting thing that happened when the FEC adopted these regulations in 1979, it was reversing itself 180 degrees from a policy that it had already announced to the League of Women Voters. You may remember the League used to sponsor these debates. And the Federal Election Commission, which is an administrative agency, not a lawmaking body, administrative agency, they told the League of Women Voters in 1976, you cannot use corporate money to sponsor these debates because you're not inviting all of the legally qualified candidates. 1979, they turn around, create a new law, a loophole allowing corporations to throw money into the process, completely in contradiction to this multi-decade-old federal law. And shortly thereafter, the Democratic-Republican parties get together. They create this thing called the Commission on Presidential Debates. They essentially push the League of Women Voters out of the debate sponsorship program, you know, out of that whole possibility. The League saying at the time they do not want to participate in the hoodwinking of the American public. And for the past three election cycles, the CPD has been taking corporate money and using that corporate money to put on these big, what in our effect, advertisements for the two major party candidates. And this plain violation of federal law sort of raises three obvious problems. You've got corporate money p- potentially corrupting the participants in the debate, as well as the people who stage the debate, shaping the questions that are asked, shaping the terms of the discussion, the range of the discussion. You also have the problem of the government all of a sudden saying to the American people, reversing 9 decades of law, saying, well, it is okay for corporations to have a say in who is an acceptable candidate, who is a viable candidate for office. It's okay for the corporations to use their money to affect government policy. And this violates the position of neutrality that any government is bound to have towards any of its elections. And, you know, lastly, and perhaps most importantly, this marriage between the processes of self-government and commerce, I think, is disheartening to a lot of people in this country. People sit back and feel that things are out of their hands, that the decisions on who should be included in debates are well beyond the scope of them having any participation, and it jeopardizes their willingness to participate in public governance. So this lawsuit, just in sum, is attacking the regulations adopted by the FEC, which is itself a creature of the Democratic and Republican parties, to allow corporate money to come in and tilt the electoral playing field.
And, Amy, I think this is especially important right now when, for instance, the polls that are being done, the presidential polls, are showing a rapid climb in interest in the Nader candidacy. For instance, USA Today reported in a new poll in today's edition that their new national poll shows that Nader is getting 6% support, whereas a May 31st poll done by Reuters between May 28th and May 31st showed Nader at 4%, and Buchanan is coming in steadily at 2% in voter support. So there appears to be a growing support for Nader. In California, he's polling at about 10% of the electorate. Who knows what might be the situation by the end of the Democratic and Republican conventions, and for this debate commission to not allow viable candidates who are on the ballot, as Nader appears that he will be on the ballot in most states, and Buchanan certainly will, to be able to debate and give the American people more choices, force both Gore and Bush to more clearly define their positions, as you know that a Pat Buchanan would and a Ralph Nader would, I think is in essence an attempt to rig the election.
Absolutely. If I could just add one important point to that. Back in April, early April, a Zogby Reuters poll showed, and this is a poll that said, we know the CPD has put out this 15% threshold for inclusion in the debates, but knowing that, who do you want to hear in the debate? Not who do you want to vote for, but who do you want to hear in the debate? And over 50% of the people polled in this country said they wanted to hear from Ralph Nader. They wanted to hear from Patrick Buchanan. And that's because Americans remember what these debates are for. And they are for the contention, the contending of different political ideas. The two major parties, as we all know, agree on so many basic, truly important critical issues before the American public. And the American public wants to, whether or not they intend to vote for these candidates, they want to hear those ideas thrown up against the ideas of their, perhaps the people they do support. Americans remember what these debates are for. They remember the history of these debates. They're supposed to be a great social dialogue. They're not supposed to be a pre-election. It's not a pre-primary. And the whole rhetoric used by Frank Fahrenkopf and Paul Kirk in their defenses in the AP Newswire stories over the past 2 days are outrageous. They compare the debates to playoff games, a ridiculous sports analogy, as if there's been a full season of electoral activity before Labor Day when they make their cutoff decision. In point of fact, most people don't really start focusing on the debates until October before the elections. This is when the season starts, and this is when America deserves to have a full range of discussion on important issues of the day.
You know, I should add that we did invite Frank Fahrenkopf and any spokesperson of the Commission on Presidential Debates to join us for this program. Actually, we started by trying for Wednesday, then Thursday, then today, and each day we were put off, and they said, well, sometime next week, but we no longer had hope. We do, though, hope to be able to talk to them at some point, but felt this was a critical issue, especially as we move into the Green Party convention. But Juan, you were just talking about Nader yesterday standing with Jimmy Hoffa, the president of the Teamsters, and we wanted to give our listeners just a little sampling of what they had to say. This is beginning with Teamsters chief Jimmy Hoffa and Nader.
No one in the political arena speaks stronger on the issues important to American working families than Ralph Nader. Ralph Nader understands what globalization means. Money and jobs are going overseas.
People are always asking, am I worried about taking votes away from Gore? No, I'm worried about Gore taking votes away from me.
And the labor movement seems to have been written out of this debate. I mean, who talks about labor anymore except us and except Ralph Nader? And that's what the problem is. Are we irrelevant?
But the labor... That was some of the discussion yesterday of Hoffa and the Teamsters. Juan?
Well, Amy, one of the points that I've been trying to raise to some of my colleagues in some of the major media organizations in the last few weeks is that just because the Presidential Debate Commission has already set this unlevel playing field, that is not preventing major national news organizations from dismissing their approach. For instance, there's nothing to prevent CNN from sponsoring its own presidential debates where it would invite all four of the candidates. There's nothing preventing PBS or some other major media organization from saying we're not going to follow the tune or the direction of the two major political parties. We as media organizations who have a responsibility to the general public are going to create a new debate format, and I would hope that some of those journalists committed to fairness in their presentation of the news and of issues to the public will listen to that. And between now and November, hopefully a CNN or a PBS or some other major organization will take that bold step. And I think that it would be probably one of the most watched debates since back in Kennedy Nixon times.
Well, I want to thank Greg Luke of the National Voting Rights Institute for joining us. If people want to see the lawsuit, get more information, where can they call or go on the web?
Well, the best, if they have access to computers, they can try us on the web. Our website is www.nvri.org. That's the acronym of National Voting Rights Institute. And they can see the full range of our work trying to solve and work on the money and politics problem around the country.
Well, Greg Luke, I want to thank you again for being with us. And Juan, I'll see you back in New York next week as you head up from Houston. We're actually headed out today. Tonight, Democracy Now! Producer Jeremy Scahill and I will be going to Denver for the Green Party Convention. We'll be bringing you coverage of that next week on Monday and Tuesday. Tonight, we'll be part of a fundraiser for community station KGNU at the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center in Boulder, Colorado at 10 p.m., so I look forward to seeing people there. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love and Jeremy Scahill. Our engineer is Anthony Sloan. Thanks so much to Edmundo at KPFT, Pacifica Station in Houston, where Juan is. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, you can call the archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And we'd like to hear from you. Our email address is democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. On Monday, the acceptance speech of the Green Party presidential candidate, who will be nominated and confirmed on Sunday night. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!